From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, two Massachusetts congressmen on President-elect Trump's victory and what they believe is ahead for the country. Here's Representative Seth Moulton.
There are even members of our military who are talking about what it would mean to disobey the orders of the commander-in-chief because they're unconstitutional. It's frightening that we have to have those conversations today, but we do.
And Representative Jim McGovern.
We want to work with him where there's common ground. But if he wants to institutionalize discrimination or racism or xenophobia, then we need to use whatever tool is available to us to try to stop him.
Also today, we'll talk about ways to talk with your kids about this election. And we'll hear from Boston playwright Melinda Lopez and why she's telling the story of her parents' death in her compassionate and brave new play, Mala. That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On this Veterans Day, we're checking in with two members of the Massachusetts delegation for their reactions to this week's historic election. We spoke with Congressman Seth Moulton and Congressman Jim McGovern, both Democrats, of course. Moulton represents the state's 6th district. He's in Salem and Marblehead today talking to veterans. We spoke with him earlier, and I began by asking him about the Facebook and Twitter posts he made just after the election, where he wrote that he's, quote, truly sad for this country that he so deeply loves. And he went on to say, quote, each of us must step forward to work with one another. So I asked him just how the Democratic Party plans to do that, as Republicans will be in control of the White House and both chambers of Congress.
Well, it's going to be hard. But as always, we've got to find common ground to work with Republicans on shared priorities for the American people, but also stand up as a bulwark to President-elect Trump when he tries to erode the values that are so fundamental to us and that are enshrined in our Constitution.
Do you have any specific ideas or plans or areas in which you think that the Democrats should put forth the most effort in being that bulwark?
Well, of course, it depends on what Trump plans to do. But if he actually follows through on his campaign promises to discriminate against minorities, to ship people out of the country, to indiscriminately bomb folks overseas, even innocents, then we're going to have to prevent him from doing that.
Congressman, let me ask you something, because you're a thoughtful guy on this issue. Many people in the Democratic Party spent 8 years criticizing the Republican Party for being obstructionist, for saying that they were going to do everything they could to stop President Obama's agenda. I mean, are the Democrats saying the same thing now about President-elect Trump? And if so, how does that actually move the country forward in terms of finding that common ground, finding compromise solutions that can lead some policy to be enacted in Congress?
Well, I don't think anyone's saying that yet. We're saying that we're going to stand up for our fundamental values and protect the rights of all Americans if Trump assaults them. But at the same time, Democrats have a history in Congress of trying to work across the aisle, of trying to find common solutions, of not just being the obstructionist that the Republican Party has been over the past 10 years.
Now, in your district, a couple of towns did vote for Donald Trump: Salisbury, Rowley, Middleton, Wilmington. You yourself didn't have any opposition in your reelection this week. But I'm wondering, for your constituents in those towns, I mean, how do you plan on talking with them or addressing their concerns and, including what they desire in terms of your advocacy and your work in Congress?
Well, first of all, I'm a representative for everybody in the 6th District: Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Trump voters, Clinton voters, and anybody else. And I take that responsibility seriously. I'm a public servant. I'm accountable to them. I work for them every single day. So first of all, I won't forget that. Second of all, I'm going to listen. I'm actually the single Democrat in Congress, House, or Senate who's held the most town halls in the whole country this past year. I'm going to continue doing that because we need to understand the people who feel left out, who feel disillusioned, who even voted for someone that they don't think can do a good job in the Oval Office but represents change. We need to listen to those people, to hear their concerns, and to find ways that we can address them.
Well, we are speaking to you today, of course, and it's Veterans Day. So if I may, I'd love to ask you a couple of questions about the U.S. military. You yourself served for quite some time. First of all, President-elect Trump, during the campaign, had a lot to say about the military. I mean, he called, you know, the condition of the U.S. military a, quote, disaster. He said that he knows, quote, more about ISIS than the generals do. I mean, some genuinely disparaging things, even as he was throwing his support behind military veterans. So I'm wondering, what do you suggest President-elect Trump should do when he comes into office in the early days to build his relationship with the U.S. Armed Services?
Well, first of all, he has to show some fundamental respect for our military families, and for our Constitution. And he has a lot of work to do in all of those departments, given what he has said on the campaign trail, and also, frankly, his history. I mean, he has a history of disparaging veterans in the private sector long before he ever ran for president. So he has a lot of work to do to restore that respect, and or build, I should say, that respect and faith. I sit on the Armed Services Committee, and I know that there are people on both sides of the aisle who are very concerned about the things that Trump says he will do as Commander-in-Chief. There are even members of our military who are talking about what it would mean to disobey the orders of the Commander-in-Chief because they're unconstitutional. It's frightening that we have to have those conversations today, but we do. We've got to make sure that Trump makes decisions that are in the national security of interest of our country.
So, I mean, specifically, you know, what do you think the president-elect should do? I mean, is it changing the way he talks about the military? Who would you like to see appointed as, I don't know, Secretary of Defense? Are there specific things you think he could do?
Well, first of all, he needs to surround himself with smart and experienced people, because ultimately, a lot of his success or failure will be dependent on the team that he brings together. I hope he realizes that the responsibility now on his shoulder as Commander-in-Chief requires him to rise above it, not just bring in his friends and family members, his business cronies or whoever else, but actually bring in people who know what they're doing when it comes to matters so weighty as our national defense.
Well, let's talk about veterans care here for just a moment, because, of course, you're a veteran. You tried to get care at the VA. You had some difficulty doing that. According to the New York Times, this summer, some improvements had been made at the VA, because a couple of years ago, President Obama signed into law a $15 billion overhaul of health care at the Department of Veterans Affairs. But, however, the Times reported that there's still more than 500,000 veterans who wait more than a month for care. So, you know, what would you like to see done to get that number, I mean, ideally down to zero?
Well, we need to radically reform the VA, and Donald Trump has said that he wants to radically reform the VA. The problem is that the plans he's put forward would actually make it worse. And so we've got to redirect that energy in a positive direction. He wants to just outright privatize the VA, which will actually raise wait times for veterans and raise wait times for everybody else, because so many veterans would be thrown into the private health care system without any of the specialized services that the VA has designed to take care of veterans. So what veterans want, overwhelmingly, is not to privatize the VA, but to reform the VA that we have, to make it act and work more like private sector healthcare that's innovative and responsive to patients' concerns, but fundamentally retain the VA system. So those are the kinds of reforms that people like myself will be fighting for in Congress, the kinds of reforms that veterans who use the VA actually want.
And finally, Congressman, what's your hope for, you know, not just your district or Massachusetts, but the country as it moves forward, you know, in the aftermath of one of the ugliest and most divisive presidential elections we've seen in some time?
One of the hardest parts of this election for a lot of young people is they look at what's happened and say, you know, I was brought up to believe that if I was honest, if I was honorable, and I worked hard, that I could do anything in America, that the American dream can truly be mine. And now to see someone rise to the highest office in the land who hasn't really been honest and honorable is saddening, is disillusioning to a lot of people. But we can't lose faith in our country. We can't lose faith in our democracy. Winston Churchill said that America always does the right thing after we've tried everything else. And maybe this time we're trying something else, but in the long run, we've got to continue moving forward. We can't forget the fundamental principles, the values that make us Americans, that every American, no matter where you're from, what your religion is, what color your skin is, that everybody is entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We've got to preserve those values now under a Trump administration, just as we have throughout our history. And it's going to be a fight, but we're going to work on it, and we need everybody to join in that fight together.
Well, Congressman Seth Moulton is spending the day in Salem and Marblehead on this Veterans Day. He took some time to speak with us. Congressman, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Well, let's turn now to Congressman Jim McGovern. He represents Massachusetts' 2nd District. Congressman McGovern, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, happy to be with you.
Well, first of all, react to what you heard your fellow Congressman Seth Moulton say just now about the direction he'd like to see Massachusetts and the nation move forward to following this election. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I'm heartsick over this election, and I know a lot of people all throughout the country are. And the question is, how do we react? I've been trying to talk to people who've been calling me afterwards, who are in deep depression, that what we cannot do is give up. I mean, we have to do more than just agonize. We have to organize. We have to fight for what's best about this country. We can't give up on things that we all value and we think are important.
Yeah. So if we may, let's focus on your district a little bit, because we crunched some of the numbers in terms of how the voting went in the second in your district. And in 18 municipalities, more than half the voters chose Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. Did that surprise you?
Well, look, I represent a very diverse district, and there's a lot of red areas in my district. This election divided a lot of people, and people who voted for Donald Trump voted for him for a number of reasons. Some of those reasons were people just felt, detached from government and from Washington, and they were fed up and they wanted to send a message. And I understand that. And I think Democrats, we need to figure out a strategy to bring some of these people back into the fold. And a lot of the people who voted for Donald Trump, in my opinion, voted against their own self-interest. There's nothing Donald Trump has promised in terms of policies that will help the middle class or those struggling to get in the middle class. I mean, most of his tax policies are geared toward the very wealthy. But I understand the frustration that people have, and Donald Trump, through his bombast, was able to capitalize on that. But I think the majority of people in my district were with Hillary Clinton, because not only do I believe they think that she would do a great job as president, but they understand that anger is not a strategy. It's not a policy.
I mean, you are right that the majority of voters in your district did choose Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. The margin there was 55-37%. But that's tighter than it was across the state as a whole on average. So I guess what I'm curious about is, have you had conversations since Tuesday with any of your constituents who did vote for Donald Trump? I mean, how are you reaching out to them? And does this change at all sort of how you want to represent your district in Washington?
Well, I've had lots of conversations with people who supported Hillary and with people who supported Trump, and I expect those conversations will continue. And I think one of my biggest concerns is that Donald Trump's campaign has really been, for all of his talk about how he's campaigning against the elite, his campaign, in terms of his economic policies, is really about embracing the elite, about embracing those who are powerful and those who are well off. And to kind of add on to what my colleague Seth Moulton said, the other part of his campaign, which has really been disturbing to me, has been the focus on division and polarization and hate. I was quite frankly shocked as a result of many encounters I had during this last year with people who basically embraced some of the most hateful aspects of Trump's candidacy, the sexism, the racism, the xenophobia. There's some deep divisions that he helped sow, and we need to figure out a way to bring this country back together. And we need to figure out a way of dealing with some of these issues that people don't want to talk about, like the fact that we still have systemic racism in this country, that women are still not treated equally in this country. Those things have to be addressed. We can't ignore that. And we can't ignore the hate and the division of his campaign. I'm not saying everybody who supported him is in that category. As I said, a lot of people supported him because they were frustrated with their economic situation. But a lot of people out there did support him based on, I think, some of the more dark parts of his campaign.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, Congressman, on that point, now that the Democrats are the minority in both houses of Congress, I mean, what can the Democratic Party do do to specifically do to bridge those divides you were just talking about?
Well, part of it is that we need to talk about some of the issues more candidly than we've been willing to do in the past. And we need to try to propose solutions that people believe in. And where there are areas we can agree on, we should agree with them. But where there are areas we don't, you know what? We need to fight.
Yeah. So, Congressman, let me ask you something about that, because I asked this same question to Congressman Moulton as well. You know, I hear in both of you the sense that when it comes to core Democratic values, that you'll fight for them if necessary. And what I asked Congressman Moulton a little earlier was, you know, for 8 years, many people pointed to the Republican Party as a party of obstructionism, a party that just said no to everything that it believed or that it didn't believe in regarding President Obama's agenda. Do the Democrats risk putting themselves in that same position of over the course of a Trump presidency, becoming an obstructionist party, becoming a party that says no because Democrats feel like they would be fighting for the things they believe in?
Well, as I said, we want to work with him where there's common ground. But if he wants to institutionalize discrimination or racism or xenophobia, then we need to use whatever tool is available to us to try to stop him. We're kind of at a crossroads in this country, and I don't want to move backwards. I've been having these conversations with my 15-year-old daughter, who is devastated over this election. She can't quite understand how a man got elected who said the things that he said.
What are you telling her?
Well, what I'm telling her is, we'll get through this. This is a strong country. It's a resilient country. And, just like we were saying all during the campaign, I really do believe that at the end of the day, love trumps hate. I really do. There are a lot of Republicans that I serve with who I know are deep down concerned about a Trump presidency. They don't embrace a lot of the things that he said during the campaign about building walls and deporting Muslims, and certainly were outraged by his comments about women. That's not the country they want either. There's no doubt we have some challenges ahead of us. But here's the deal. I mean, I've been obviously pretty depressed after the election results. But I've told this to my staff, and I've told this to people who called me. We're not defeated. We got to get together, and we got to stand up for what's right. And what's right at the end of the day is not just what the Democrats think or versus what the Republicans think. There are some things that everybody should think falls under the category of right: respecting every individual, being against discrimination, empowering women, increasing wages for workers across this country, building a fairer, better system for everybody. I think there are some things out there that fall into the category of right that may defy political labels, and we need to try to build these coalitions to make sure that those things move forward.
Hmm. Well, Congressman Jim McGovern represents Massachusetts' 2nd District. He's speaking with us today from Hardwick. Congressman, thank you so very much for taking the time.
Happy to be with you.
So that's the view from two Massachusetts congressmen. Let's hear what the state's senior senator has to say. Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke about her vision for the nation's future yesterday. She was at the AFL-CIO Executive Council in Washington. And she acknowledged how brutally divisive and toxic this election was, and that President-elect Trump rode a wave of anger to victory. But then Senator Warren added that Americans have a right to be angry. Here's an excerpt of her speech.
Angry that wages have been stagnant for a generation while basic costs like housing and health care and child care have skyrocketed. Angry that our political system is awash in barely legalized campaign bribery. Angry that Washington tilts the playing field for giant corporations, giving them special privileges and letting them amass enormous economic and political power. Angry that while Washington dithers and spins and does the backstroke in an ocean of money, while the American dream moves further and further out of reach for most families. President-elect Trump spoke to these issues. Republican elites hated him for it, and he didn't care. He did it anyway. He criticized Wall Street's big money and their dominance in Washington, straight up. He supported a new Glass-Steagall bill. He spoke against the need for reform of our trade deals so they aren't the raw deal for the American people. He spoke of the urgency of rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and putting people back to work. He spoke to the very real sense that millions of Americans have that their government and their economy has abandoned them. The deep worry that people feel over an America that does not work for them is not a liberal worry or a conservative worry. It is not a Democratic worry or a Republican worry. It is the deep worry that led even Americans with deep reservations about Donald Trump's temperament and fitness to vote for him anyway. So let me be 100% clear about this. When President-elect Trump wants to take on these issues, when his goal is to increase the economic security of middle-class families, then count me in. I will push aside our differences, and I will work with him to achieve that goal. If Trump is ready to go on rebuilding American economic security for millions of families, then I am ready, and so are a lot of other people, Democrats and Republicans. As the loyal opposition, we will fight harder, we will fight longer, and we will fight more passionately than ever for the rights of every human being in this country to be treated with respect and dignity. And we do not control the tools of government, but make no mistake, we know what we stand for. The sun will keep rising, and we will keep fighting. Each day, every day, we will fight for the working people of this country. That's what we will do. The time for ignoring the American people is over. It is time for us to come together to work on America's agenda. Democracy demands that we do so. And we are ready.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking yesterday at the AFL-CIO Executive Council in Washington. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Wednesday morning, I took one of my kids to school, and just about every parent in the hallway was talking about the election and wondering how to talk to their kids about the election. And maybe you've heard similar conversations or even had them yourself. For some parents, it's the challenge of talking to your kids about their disappointments and fears. And for other parents, it may be the challenge of helping your child navigate complicated social interactions because your candidate won. So for some guidance, let's turn now to Jennifer Sappas. She's a therapist who works with families and children in Beverly, Massachusetts, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
And listeners, I'm wondering if you've been having these kinds of conversations with your kids. What have you been telling them? What are your questions about how to talk to your kids about this very divisive and toxic election and how we all move forward together? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So Jennifer, first of all, let me just start off. I mean, how many parents and kids have you talked to about this? I mean, are you finding that children are aware of the election and its aftermath?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this has been a topic that's come up in therapy sessions really since the start of this very different election season. And parents have been struggling with how to talk to their kids about the sort of language that's been used and how that's contradictory to sort of what we're talking to kids now about, how to solve conflict, how to talk about feelings. And for anxiety, children with anxiety, particularly the sort of uncertainty and emotional charge of this election season has made things very difficult. I think after the election, probably the most significant impact was sort of the collective shock of the outcome, regardless of sort of people's voting preferences. And I think that sets a tone both at home and in the environment for children of more uncertainty, so more anxiety.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about that, because I think that, again, just to underscore it, you said regardless of party or who adults may have voted for, I think this is a conversation in most households across the country right now. But it takes on different tones, and there are different sort of points of concentration. So, I mean, and there's always, when it comes to talking about kids, there's always the question of age-appropriate conversations.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But let's just talk about, you know, what advice you might give to families who say, you know, who they themselves are minorities, or their children are, you know, people of color, or they're one of any of the groups that were targeted in a sense during this election. And now, I mean, I've been hearing lots of stories about kids being afraid about their own futures. I mean, how do you reassure a child?
I think that's a very real fear. And so this is the challenge in terms of there is something to be anxious about for many families and children, and but with a sort of uncertain path. And so that what we rely on to cope in crisis in terms of the sort of activating things that happen in our brains and our bodies when we're anxious are happening, but without a clear path of how to help children to feel like there's someone in charge of the greater holding environment for them. And so I think it's very important for parents to be aware in schools and adults and kids' lives to be aware of the need for stability, for continuity, for reassurance that things are not going to change in their child's life right now. And to talk about how there's sort of systems in place so that sudden things just don't happen. We have laws that one person can't make one decision for an entire group of people, that that they're protected, while also validating the fear. That's a very tricky thing to do.
Yeah. So how do you do that? I mean, just say you're speaking to, I don't know, an 8-year-old, 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a risk in... You want to validate how they feel, which includes validating their fear without amplifying
That's it. Right. Yes. And that's exactly the sort of middle path to find. And I think what we can talk about are things that are helpful for anxiety in general, focusing on the present, what we can do in the here and now to reestablish our safety, to talk about the what ifs, to really very calmly explore and encourage dialogue with your child, to be very curious about what it is that they understand the risk to be, because we don't want to necessarily give them fears if they don't have them, which is also, you know, a common problem that can happen when as adults we're afraid too. And so to sort of slow down and talk very openly and encourage language that helps your child to be very clear with you about what it is that exactly they fear, and to be mindful of things like, you know, sort of.
Can I just get a little more specific
here?
Because, again, I'm just reflecting on some of the conversations we've had and heard on this program over the course of the week. You know, for example, I heard a story of someone saying, you know, their child basically, they're immigrants, and their child after the election said, am I going to get kicked out of the country? I mean, this election has been so visceral that I think there are a lot of children who have actually, like, practical concerns, which... You know, they can't understand the nuances of what was said and why it was said during the election. They simply heard the words. And so, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, that's right. And I think that we do have to understand developmentally where the child is at in terms of what they're able to understand and how important it is to protect children from media and sources of information at a level that they're just not developmentally able to understand. And that's why it is important to first be curious about what they think is going to happen and then provide reassurance that we can, you know, in terms of how these changes are made, that, you know, some of these threats were made in a very emotional, angry way, and that doesn't mean that they were true, that a lot of what they might have heard is wrong, that there are adults are there to protect them and to make sure that even if that regardless of what happens in the future, they will be there to guide them and who are those adults and have them identify who those safe adults are and to reiterate over and over in any way that you can what their context of safety is in this moment in their lives.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick call here. Patrick is calling from Milton. You're on the air, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's your thought today?
Good, good. Just a quick question. So as far as, you know, with all of the election results, what, how come there were no similar, you know, people there to help the crisis in 2008 and 2012?
When President Obama won and people feeling devastated by his victory. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I just find it curious, the adjective you're using, crisis, aftermath. I mean, this wasn't even a conversation in either of those election cycles.
Yeah, I take your point. I mean, in every election cycle, someone is on the losing side, and they and their family and their children probably do feel devastated. But Patrick, I will assert, and I think many other people will too, that this election has been unlike any we've seen before in terms of the vitriol and the toxicity, and that it is different. And again, it has nothing to do with necessarily, well, it does have everything to do with who won, but it also has to do with the election as a whole and the language that we heard for over a year, for almost 18 months. So I would say that it is a bit different. But to Patrick's point, I want to ask you, Jennifer Sappas, about the flip side of things. I mean, we've been hearing stories from teachers, for example, who have kids, students in their classes who support Donald Trump and whose families supported and voted for Donald Trump. And in a way, those teachers feel as if they have to create a protected and safe space for those students from the very deep feeling and heated emotions that students who didn't support Trump are feeling. I mean, those families and those students also have conversations and concerns as well.
Yes, that's right. I think it's a very good question. I think the one thing that we can probably all agree on is that this was a very different election, and there was sort of an emotional charge and reactivity and language of fear and language used that children don't typically hear from adults in positions of authority. And all of that created a climate of sort of confusion and anxiety that regardless of who the candidates are, really, is just that context created increased fear. And I think that's why we're talking about it differently now and why it's important that we sort of are able to regain a sense of, this is sort of how we talk about our emotions safely, both in school and at home.
But specifically speaking about children and students whose families did support and voted for Donald Trump, and especially in a state like Massachusetts where, let's be honest about the makeup of the state, many neighborhoods and cities and towns are Democrat blue, even though we do have a diversity of political opinion here. I do imagine that many of those families are feeling like, you know, are they in a vilified minority now.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that there are, you know, many people who did not talk about, you know, voting for Trump, and maybe they did, and then their children may be in a position of, can I talk about this? And I think it is really important every family has their own values in terms of what's private and what's shared. And often for many families, who they vote for is private. And then this is a very public discussion, and the landscape has changed in terms of how public it is. It's social media and all these things. And so I think, really sort of talking with your child about what language they can use. And teachers and schools are very responsible for creating a climate that's safe, that's respectful, that talks about understanding differences and hopefully really modeling. Like, look, our adults did not do a very good job of showing you how to do this. And it's probably because of fear, but we need to use fear to help us to change in a way that's constructive and works towards safety. And, you know, and look at this, it's even more important that we learn how to do this.
So my final question is to you, are we underestimating the resilience of kids? Because I wonder sometimes, and maybe I'll just speak for myself, sometimes I wonder if I'm projecting my own anxieties onto my children, and that if I just stopped and listened to them, I might figure out that that they've got this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why it's so important to be curious, because projection of parental anxiety is by far a greater risk factor for children than anything they might hear on TV, especially young children, or anything that's going on in a sociopolitical climate. And so I think being very aware of how you talk about your own fears and anxiety, and children are absolutely resilient. We have a lot to learn from them about how they manage through this time in terms of what we can do to be calm and to be clear and to be comfortable with that disagreement in our feelings.
Well, Jennifer Sappas is a family and child therapist in Beverly, Massachusetts. Thank you so very much for coming in and for your guidance and advice. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Award-winning Boston playwright Melinda Lopez joins us now. She's the inaugural playwright in residence at the Huntington Theater Company. And her new one-woman play, on now at Arts Emerson, is called Mala. It tells Lopez's own story about caring for her mother at the end of her life. And from the very beginning of the show, Lopez makes it clear that while she's not going to sugarcoat some of the tough realities of end-of-life care, she's also going to treat them with a knowing tenderness. For example, right off the bat, Lopez tells the audience, don't turn off your cell phones because you might have someone who you're supposed to be taking care of. And every time you have to turn the phone off, you panic a little bit and spend the whole time wondering if they fell or died while you were at the theater. Melinda Lopez joins us now in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Why did you decide to open Mala this way? Because, I mean, from right off the bat, you're connecting straight with people in the audience and saying, I've been there.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I'm doing, too, is I'm cutting across all theater protocol. You know, there are ways we're supposed to behave when we're in our right minds. And sometimes we're living in a place of extremes. And even at the theater, we're checking our phones because we're in a panic. So I wanted to address it and call it by its name and say, yeah, like you said, I've been there. So I have compassion for you. Let's not pretend this isn't happening.
And so when you open this way, can you feel a certain energy from the audience?
Yeah, people laugh. You know, it's hard going to the theater. You have all these things you're supposed to do. You know, you have to talk to your neighbors. The lights are on. I'm really acknowledging people are going to look at you're going to look at each other. You're going to sit together in this room. And we're also going to have a good time. You know, the theme of the piece is tough. It's sad. It's something that many of us are going through now, and it's something that many of us will face. But I also want to really take care of the audience and say, we're going to find ways to laugh about it, and we're going to get through it.
Yeah. Your father died in 2014,
yes.
And your mother in 2015.
Yes.
And your mother was 92?
They were both 92 when they died.
They were both 92.
And, you know, my parents had what I think many people would define as good deaths. They had really full lives. They lived vigorously. They were aware to the end. They didn't suffer needlessly. And so this question of, you know, we talk a lot about what's a good death, what does it mean to be in charge of end-of-life care? And even with all that information, even with all the books we read, even with all the good, knowledgeable people, it's still so hard.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's still hard. It's still painful. As a caregiver, you second guess everything. I did. I'll speak for myself. You never know that you're making the right choices. And sometimes you have to make choices. That's the nature of our mortality.
Yeah. So tell me more about, especially with your mother, because you were her primary caregiver at the end of her life.
Yeah.
And that's what the play is really focused on.
Yes. So my mom, my house has an apartment where my parents lived. My father passed away the year before. And my mother had a series of health challenges that were difficult to diagnose, some kind of mysterious ailments, things happened. And so we didn't have any kind of clear sign, but She knew what she wanted.
I was going to say, yeah, because on top of that, you had a strong dose of a very strong-willed woman.
She knew she wanted to be home. And she made that very clear, and there were a lot of clashes. There's this interesting dynamic where it feels like the parent is becoming the child, and the child has to take responsibilities, and sometimes no one wants to give up their power. And that comes across in the play, I think, in a humorous way. But my mother, you know, she made some choices. She went into hospice care. We had great care coming to the house at home. And I was with her, and my sister, we were with her every step of the way. My daughter was present. And still, you know, there were moments that were wonderful and beautiful and moments that were extremely challenging.
Can you tell us about one of the challenging moments?
So she was fond of throwing caregivers out of the house. If anyone's been through this, you know, towards the end, you start trying to bring in more and more people, cover more hours. And, you know, if my mother didn't like you right off the bat, and she made no bones about it. And that's something that I laugh about now. But at the time, you know, you've worked hard to get a person there. You have a schedule. You know, I'm what they call a sandwich, right? So I'm caring for a child and caring for an older parent. I think there are a lot of us out there. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things I wanted to talk about with this piece, you know, going through it, I felt alone. But of course, I'm not alone. It's a very universal experience. And one of the ways I found solace was talking to people who had had experiences, and they would tell their stories. And some of those stories have made their way into the play as well. So it's not just my story. It's friends. It's colleagues. Yeah. It's, you know, the man who came to put in the blinds one day, and he pulled me aside and he said, I have to tell you about my father. He's driving me crazy, you know. And so it's this great unseen and unspoken of event that many of us are in the middle of,
which is one of the reasons why putting it on stage and in the form of a one-woman play, it seems so very right, because you really are in dialogue and in conversation with the people watching, right, watching the production, and I want to talk about that more in just a second, but just to get back to the sort of the orbit of stories that's in the play, you're very honest about your experience and the experience of everyone in your family as well. I mean, you talk about how your sister, I mean, you were the primary caregiver for your parents, and your sister came, but not as frequently as you would have liked, and that was the source of some tension.
Well, I think any family with siblings, right, there's gonna be tension, and the workload generally tends to fall on one sibling or one child, and it's human nature, right? We fight about everything. I will say, you know, my sister was incredibly generous and incredibly helpful and was there when I needed her to be. And I'm very grateful to her support. But yeah, if someone falls in the middle of the night, if someone presses the alert button, you know, there's one of us that's going to be there. How families cope with challenges also, I think, often leads to humor, and it's very theatrical. So it makes for a good story.
By definition. I don't think anyone will disagree with that, right? Well, we're speaking with Melinda Lopez. She's a Boston, award-winning Boston playwright and actress, and we're speaking about her new play called Mala. I should ask you about the title of the play. Mala, meaning the bad one?
So it's a Spanish word. My parents were Cuban Americans, we're a bilingual family. So I say in the play, mala means bad, but more than bad, it means your essential self is bad. Not that you've done something bad, but that you are in your core bad. Mother calls daughter mala, daughter calls mother mala. At some points in the play, you can see one of the characters is more mala than the other. But I think it's also this tension of wanting to be good and wanting to support the people that you love and wanting to be the good daughter, right? That's her great. I talk about her in the third person because she's the character I'm playing, but she's also me, right? Wanting to be the one who pulls it together, who makes the right choices. And you're bound to fail sometimes. Yeah. You're bound to be mala, right? And so that tension of who gets called the name and when permeates the play.
But this is the one thing which I think, yes, it's true. Everyone's going to be Mala at one point in time, but they don't want to be Mala, if I can still use the term, for this, right? Because it's the end of life. Right. And I think, I mean, I'm not there yet with my parents. It's obviously going to be in my future. But it's the one thing where you think after, you know, your mother or father are gone, there's no going back and undoing the moments where you felt uncertain or maybe didn't felt like you didn't make the right decision. Right. Right?
So, yeah, the pressure is enormous to be perfect, to rise to the occasion. And, you know, the character goes back and forth. She says at one point, you know, you have to choose your battles. And in my life, you know, this battle just seemed inevitable. And then she stops and says, no, I don't mean that. I mean, welcome. I'm ready. I signed on. It's not like I didn't sign on. That's what the good daughter does, right? You enter into it knowing, you think you're armed with all the information. And then the nature of our human mortality is that it's chaotic and you can't predict it. I talk about one episode where my mother fell and she seemed to be fine. And we decided not to send her to the hospital. I said, stay home, have some coffee, put your feet up. And 2 days later, it turned out that she had a subdural hematoma and was rushed to the hospital and spent almost 3 months recovering because of a decision that I made, thinking I was doing the right thing. You know, and she recovered from that and she learned to walk again. She learned to talk again. She had 5 great years after that. But that haunted me because I made the wrong choice. Right. And one of the things I reckon with in the play is I will always send her to the hospital. And then I get to the point where she won't go. And so we have to bring hospice home. And that was the right decision. So not sending her once almost cost her her life, and not sending her again later, that was what she really wanted. So you just don't know.
Yeah.
You can't know. You can't know.
Now, the theater is a space where, by definition, people are making themselves vulnerable, both on stage and in the audience, by opening themselves up to listening to these stories. Is there something about theater as an art form that made it the right space for telling this story?
Oh, yeah. I believe so strongly that theater is a place where healing happens. And I don't want it to sound very touchy-feely, but I think, right, we come together as strangers and we sit in a dark room together and we experience a story. And in any kind of theater, there's going to be compassion, there's going to be big ideas. And you're going to learn something about someone who is a stranger to you at the beginning. And I, you know, I'll also just say, I think at this point where we are, you know, today with our country, if we're going to heal our country, we're not going to do it over Twitter. We're going to do it face to face, shoulder to shoulder, looking each other in the eye. And I think theater is a place that lends itself to that. There are many spaces, churches, schools, town meetings. There are lots of spaces that lend itself to that. But theater is one of them. I really believe that with all my heart. My experience with audiences after the show is that they're profoundly moved and they want to talk about their experiences because they've also felt alone. And I'm trying to offer a forum where it's okay to laugh about sad things or cry about funny things, right?
Yeah, and to just to acknowledge the truth and existence of both those feelings in our complex lives.
Yeah, so it's such a profoundly human experience and one that we'll all face in some form, whether it's our own death or the death of someone we love, the death that we're prepared for, right? Which is different than the unexpected death.
Well, Melinda Lopez is an award-winning Boston playwright and actress. We've been talking about her new play. It's called Mala, and it's on at Arts Emerson now through November 20th, and we have a lot more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Magna.
We want to end today with note of another loss. Singer, songwriter, poet, and novelist Leonard Cohen died yesterday at his home in Los Angeles. He was 82. And I think Rolling Stone magazine put it best, writing, quote, "As he plainly sang, he was ready to go. It was the world that wasn't ready to lose him. For nobody wrote such magnificently bleak ballads for brooding alone in the dark or staring at a window or wall. There was Joan of Arc, Chelsea Hotel, and of course, Anthem, with the lines, ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in." So we'll go out today with what might be Leonard Cohen's most famous and possibly most covered song, a piano version of Hallelujah. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.